Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Presidential primaries, where did they come from? Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In 17 days, the state-by-state slog to the presidential nomination will finally begin for both Democrats and Republicans. Since 1952, the winner has been decided before the pageants both parties still euphemistically call their nominating conventions. It's often said that the primaries have replaced smoke-filled rooms with the voice of the people. Is that really true? Are primaries the best way for divided political parties to choose their leaders? Today's talking point, the ancient strategy of starvation, is being used as a weapon of war in Syria. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Teddy Roosevelt tried to use primary elections to get back into the White House in 1912, but primaries didn't become the way for both parties to nominate their candidates until 1972. With just a few days till the state-by-state process begins again, does it really provide the voice of the people? Today's talking point, a tactic dating back to the earliest days of organized combat, is now being used in 21st century Syria. The UN says starvation has become a weapon of war. First is news update. The Obama administration today announced a halt to all new coal mining leases on public lands. It's a step toward curbing climate change. The move was telegraphed by the president in Tuesday's State of the Union address.
And that's why I'm going to push to change the way we manage our oil and coal resources, so that they better reflect the cost they impose on taxpayers and our planet.
Alana Shore is energy reporter for Politico. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
What does this mean for the coal industry? It's already in trouble.
Well, in fact, the coal industry is being walloped by a slide in prices, by falling demand in Asia, which no longer wants to buy as much of their product. And now what this means is, although the Obama administration says there'll be enough to keep production going for 20 years, it means they don't have a shot at new leases on federal lands for the foreseeable future with no end date.
Do they want new leases on federal land if they can't sell their coal in Asia?
Well, again, that's an open question. If you ask the administration, they say no one wants to even use this land, so it's a perfectly good time for us to study the climate impacts. But if you ask the industry, this land was available cheap. It was a good deal for them, so they are livid.
Is this something that a Republican president could overturn?
Absolutely. There's not really a regulation right now that's instituting this de facto moratorium. It's just kind of in the form of an announcement from the Interior Department saying we're going to take 3 years to do an exhaustive environmental review of the federal coal program, examining things like what coal exports to Asia might mean, examining the effect on wildlife, and a lot of other areas in addition to climate change. But if a Republican wins the White House, it's foreseeable that they would try to unravel it.
So they're calling it a halt to all new coal mining leases, but they're really conducting a review. I suppose there's always the possibility they might allow more at the end of the review.
Absolutely. If you recall, after the Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010, there was a similar pause on offshore drilling leases while a safety review was conducted. It's quite possible the program will resume. But what's undeniable is, especially if a Democrat wins the White House this year, that there will now be a lot more cost involved in this. There's talk of using what we call the social cost of carbon to add new carbon royalty monies that the industry would have to pay.
Which public lands in which states are involved?
The bulk of the debate centers on the Powder River Basin, which is located in Wyoming and Montana. About 40% of all U.S. coal is produced on federal lands, and the overwhelming majority of that coal comes from Powder River. Right now, Western coal is a lot cheaper to mine than Appalachian coal, and that's one of the reasons that government auditors, independent, nonpartisan folks, have been calling for this reform for years.
We're talking with Lana Shore of Politico. Here's a bit more from the State of the Union speech.
Gas under $2 a gallon ain't bad either. Now we've got to accelerate the transition away from old, dirtier energy sources. Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future.
Back to Alana Shore. Do low gas prices, are they a double-edged sword, particularly when it comes to Wall Street?
Absolutely. The president crowed about domestic oil and gas production when it was driving, you know, economic success and a rising Dow. So now that he's saying, you know, this cheap gas is a good thing, and also I'm presiding over a landmark economic recovery, it becomes a trickier line to walk, especially when these regulations are coming out hitting the industry. Republicans really want to make him pay for that.
Well, now we've had an enormous decline on Wall Street today. It was down at 500 points at one point. When we went to air, it was down 442 points. That's still a big drop. What does that have to do with oil prices?
In fact, it's oil prices that are driving that bus for the Dow lately. We saw oil reach levels we haven't seen since 2003 today, under $30 a barrel. Milk is more expensive than oil now. It's really unprecedented, and a lot of this panic you're seeing in the market comes from that. But a lot of that comes from Iran. We're about to see this major report tomorrow that could pave the way for Iran to re-enter the world oil market, and that is spooking people.
What about Saudi Arabia? What is it doing?
In addition to its own conflicts with Iran, Saudi Arabia is signaling that it will use its influence in OPEC to keep production where it is now, which is to say pretty darn high. And that poses a serious threat to U.S. producers.
What about Iran? Now, will it be able to compete under those circumstances?
Well, keep in mind, Iran still won't be allowed to do business directly with U.S. producers and importers, but it is seeking partnerships with Europe. So it's quite possible that we could see almost a million more barrels per day come online by the end of next year if this works for Iran.
So back to coal. What's the next step we're going to see with regard to this moratorium?
Well, before the president leaves office, he's promised to release what they call an initial progress report, basically issuing some sort of recommendation, a roadmap, if you will, for a Democrat who might win the White House to use to put in some lasting changes to the way these coal leases are sold and what the industry has to pay. But again, keep in mind, if a Republican comes into office, all those government lawyers are going to be working on how to undo everything. So, again, it's a 3-year process. We won't see the resolution till then.
Alana Shore, energy reporter for Politico. It's great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, presidential primaries. Where do they come from? On To the Point from PRI.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Republicans staged another raucous reality show last night in South Carolina. Democrats will go at it again on Sunday evening. Then, starting on the first of next month, voters will finally be heard from in the caucuses and primaries that determine their nominees for the presidency in a state-by-state process. It hasn't always worked that way. Jeffrey Cowan is professor of communications at the University of Southern California. He's author of a new book called Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. Jeff Cowan, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
So this was not invented by the Founding Fathers.
That's true. I mean, they didn't exist. In fact, the Founding Fathers didn't even invent political parties.
They didn't like political parties.
Much like political parties. But until 1912, the way in which people were selected was first through the caucus system inside of just the members of Congress, pick the party members and the nominees of those parties. And then in 1832, thanks to Andrew Jackson, the Democratic convention, others all went through convention systems with the so-called smoke-filled rooms. It wasn't until 1912 with Theodore Roosevelt that there were first presidential primaries.
Tell us more about how Theodore Roosevelt got it all going.
Well, at first he didn't even believe in primaries, and of course that's a common theme, Warren, the fact that people are always a little opportunistic about the way they want the process to work. But he was going to challenge William Howard Taft, who was his successor. Roosevelt had been president from 1901 to 1909, picked William Howard Taft, the most lovable man he knew, as his successor, and then became disillusioned with him, but also wanted to come back from the isolation that he felt to sort of get back into things. And so he wanted to get the presidency for himself, or the Republican nomination. At first, he thought that he could get it through the old system by being friends with the old bosses. But when he finally decided there was no other way to do it, his only choice was to embrace an idea that people to his left had, which was the idea of presidential primaries.
Did it work?
Well, they finally created 13 primaries that year. And the primaries were responsible for something like a quarter to a third of the delegates, and then he won some other delegates, too. He ultimately won 9 of those 13 primaries, and about 70% of the delegates that were selected. So he thought going into the Republican convention that year that he was entitled to become the nominee. But the system worked, and actually, Warren, you and I are old enough to remember when it worked, continued to work this way, that the insiders still could control enough votes so that William Howard Taft, despite having lost almost all the primaries, was still able to get the nomination. Of course, as people may have read about over the years, Roosevelt in 1912, when he didn't get the nomination, walked out and started a third party.
So there was a sort of hiatus then, as far as primaries were concerned, after 1912.
Well, there were still primaries. They sort of went up and down in terms of the number of them, and they sometimes could prove that somebody was a viable candidate, as they did, for example, with Adlai Stevenson in 1960, whereby being a Catholic, people had thought that he couldn't win, and he ran in a Protestant state of West Virginia and proved that a Catholic could win even in a Protestant state. But there were never enough delegates selected to really control the convention until 1972.
Let me go for that update to Barbara Norander. She's a professor at the University of Arizona, author of The Imperfect Primary, Oddities, Biases, and Strengths of U.S. Presidential Nomination Politics. Good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
So 1972, according to Jeff Cowan, the primaries made the call. What happened in 1968, 4 years before?
Well, 1968 was a very year with a lot of events happening, the Vietnam War, lots of protests. And that sort of spilled over into the Democratic nomination. So Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy ran as anti-war candidates, and Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president, declared fairly late, I believe it was in March, that he wasn't going to run for re-election. And then Hubert Humphrey stepped in as his replacement, but did not run in any of the primaries. So you had primary battles between McCarthy and Kennedy, and Humphrey doing the more traditional path of working with the party leaders. All of that sort of boiled over at the convention, where there were protests outside the convention, lots of battles inside the convention, and the Kennedy and McCarthy supporters inside the convention in particular felt that they did not get the delegates that they were due, in part because there were about 15 or 16 primaries that year. And even if they had won all of those delegates, it still would not be enough. But also because they didn't get as many that they thought they would get from some of the primaries. So out of all that turmoil, the Democrats created a reform commission, generally called the McGovern-Fraser Commission, that wrote the first national rules for selecting delegates to the Democratic Convention.
So then what happened in 1972?
Well, many states, in order to sort of comply with these new Democratic rules, switched from their older methods to presidential primaries. So the number of presidential primaries creeps up in the 1970s. Until 72, there were, I don't remember, but there were quite a few more. And by 1976, the majority of the delegates were being selected through the presidential primaries. So now candidates could actually win the nomination by winning the primaries.
So quickly back to Jeff Cowan, author of Theater, Let the People Rule. The new primaries that came after 1972 were real primaries. They weren't just favorite sons that was one of the strategies or one of the ways that primaries were organized previously. It was just the state that would send delegates. And then while they were at the convention, they'd get into debates about who was actually going to be nominated.
Well, that allowed for a lot of horse trading back in those days, as you're suggesting. Or there might be primaries where you'd vote for a slate of delegates, but the delegates wouldn't be pledged to anybody. It'd be an uncommitted slate. And, of course, starting with the rules that Barbara's just referenced, which I had something to do with, you may know, at that convention in 1968. But starting with that process, almost every state, what happens is you can vote for the person who you want the delegate to actually support at the convention.
So you helped to write the new rules in 1968.
I helped to create something called the Hughes Commission with the Governor Harold Hughes of Iowa, which brought a proposal to the floor of the 1968 convention in the circumstances that Barbara's talking about, that all that turmoil of the anti-war movement and the McCarthy and Kennedy slates. I've been working for Eugene McCarthy. We were all very upset about that, and so we had a role in getting the convention to adopt a minority report, which required that all delegates to the next convention be picked through a system where people could participate in the calendar year of the election.
Was there a sort of backlash, if that's the right term, or could I say that that the strategy didn't work? Because in 1972, the anti-war candidate, George McGovern, was the one who was elected, and when the general election came up, he only won one state.
Well, there was a time when friends of mine would say that I had destroyed the Democratic Party, obviously with some joking, but with some evidence, because it did, for a couple of cycles we had trouble.
Let me go to Jay Cost. He's a writer at the Weekly Standard. He's also author of A Republic No More, Big Government and the Rise of American Political Corruption. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Bring us up to date as far as the Republicans were concerned, or are concerned, I should say. What were they doing in 1968, 1972, and subsequently?
Well, the Republican Party's presidential process was very similar to the Democratic process in general, and you really begin to see this sort of transition more towards primaries and open caucuses at least take effect in 1976, where Ronald Reagan sort of rallies hard at the end and almost, you know, wins a number of sufficient number of delegates to take the nomination away from incumbent President Gerald Ford.
Is this appropriate, or was it appropriate, in your opinion, to the Republicans to adopt essentially the same process that the Democrats had?
Well, the Republicans did not have the same problem that the Democrats had in the 1960s. The Republicans were much more ideologically and socioeconomically homogenous. So I don't think that there was the same need for it. I think, in general, when the reforms were implemented, they were a step in the right direction because it was about sort of removing faulty mediators between the party at large and the eventual nominee. I mean, the argument on the floor in 68 and also in the McGovern-Frazier Commission was that the party bosses had become incapable of reflecting the interests and the wants and needs and aspirations of the party at large, and I think that was a fair critique. I think the problem since then is that there is a new edifice, a new medium or a new media that has been built up to sort of act as an arbitrator between the public at large and the eventual, you know, selection, which is itself now problematic.
So this is a very different thing then that's developed much more recently than 1976.
Yeah, that's right. And you can sort of see the development slowly over time where, you know, McGovern in 72 and then Carter in 76 are sort of candidates who are able to take advantage of sort of the new rules and the inability of the party as a whole to sort of figure out the lay of the land. But then very quickly there's this sort of consolidation and there's adaptation too. I mean, you see this with the Democrats after whereby in 1984 they give the nomination to Walter Mondale because of the superdelegates, which were a creation of sort of a way to check the primaries and so on and so forth.
So, Jeffrey Cowan, that's a holdover, is it not, from the convention system?
Well, the superdelegates, which are a really interesting point, and by the way, I think that Jay's written a terrific piece about all of this from the Republican Party standpoint. But the superdelegates, which are really picked without reference to what anybody wants, really is a throwback to what we were confronting back in 1968. And the Democratic Party decided they still needed that kind of a control mechanism. Interestingly, I believe the Democrats have more of those superdelegates, that is, people who are picked without any public participation, than the Republican Party does.
Let me go back to Barbara Nurander. A moment ago, Jimmy Carter was mentioned. We're about to see the Iowa caucuses, different to some extent, of course, from the primaries. Jimmy Carter sort of invented the Iowa caucuses, didn't he?
Yeah, he was sort of the first one that used it as a sort of a stepping stone. He went there numerous times before the election year. Didn't get a lot of national attention, but he would meet a lot of local Iowa people. And then he would go back to Georgia and send them thank you notes and say, I'm glad to have met you. So he built up a ground support. Although he technically didn't win the Iowa caucuses, uncommitted when the caucuses in that year.
Well, how did the Iowa caucuses come to be so important as the first opportunity for voters to actually be heard from?
Well, it's sort of modeled after 1976. So by doing well in the Iowa caucuses, Jimmy Carter got a lot of new media attention. The media also sort of discovered the caucuses in 76. That helped him win in New Hampshire and helped him gain momentum, what we call it, where he looked like he was on a roll. So now lots of candidates want to sort of mimic what Carter did, to do well in Iowa so that that will help them do well in New Hampshire and on down the line.
So, Jeffrey Cowan, back to you. In 1968, when you were working on the changes in the rules, did you anticipate that the caucus system would be a part of it, or were you just looking at primaries at that point?
Well, the Hughes Commission, which I referenced, we were thinking about primaries. I think some people believe the McGovern Commission, which came out of the convention, liked the idea of caucuses. We were really in favor of the Hughes Commission thought that people should actually be able to vote directly for who the president should be. By the way, the caucus system is not a really democratic system. For one thing, generally, it's not a secret ballot. You know how everybody's going to vote. If your boss is in the room, if your spouse is in the room, that's a problem. If you work during those hours, you're at night, if you're a firefighter or you're a police officer or you're a nurse, you can't participate. So it's not really a fully democratic system.
Jay Cost, back to you with the Weekly Standard. What about the issue of democracy? Do the primaries, as currently structured in either party, really deliver the voice of the people?
Well, you know, I have my doubts that they do. I think in a certain sense, they of course they do, because the people vote. I think that the problem that has been we have to confront now is maybe better put the limits of democracy in a situation such as this. Because when you're asking so many people to participate and sound off on such a weighty question, there has to be some kind of mediating force or forces. And my problem, and I think that this is where McGovern-Fraser and the Hughes Commission were on the right track, where, you know, the old party conventions and the local and state bosses were supposed to at least ideally serve as a mediator of the Republican or Democratic parties at large. And there had been, you know, the corrupting forces that had inhibited their capacity to do that. And this is why the primaries and open caucuses were seen as a tonic. But we have now, over the last 45 years or so, seen this the development of this architecture of mediation, where it's, you know, campaign consultants, high money donors, now even with super PACs, which is basically limitless dark money influencing political campaigns. And then on top of that, you have the mainstream media itself, which is not, no journalistic outlet is part of any political party and need not necessarily have that party's interest in its own heart, shouldn't be considered part of the conversation. And yet, as if you watched the debate last night, you could see how what a impactful role that the decision-making process over the questions themselves, what they chose to ask, how they chose to ask them, what they chose not to ask, all of these things are enormously influential on the final result.
You have indicated in your piece, which was referred to by Jeff Cowan, that many in the media are, in fact, registered Democrats or seem to be sympathetic to the Democrats rather than Republicans. You didn't get that idea from the questions last night.
No, but, you know, the funny thing about last night is that this is this continued courtship of Donald Trump with Fox News. And so I think you see this as an apt illustration of how the problem is more, general than just, who journalists vote
okay.
for. You know, Fox News is reasonably conservative. I think by all accounts, everybody thinks that. And yet they have been enormously preferential toward Donald Trump over the years.
Hold that thought. We've now come from 1912 to today, and we will continue our conversation after a brief break. On our talking point, the ancient strategy of starvation is being used as a weapon of war in Syria. We'll talk about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. You're talking today about the presidential primary system, starting with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 and working up to Donald Trump et al. In the year that we now are living in. Here's a bit of what happened last night in Charleston, South Carolina.
Back in September, my friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way. And there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, since September, the Constitution hasn't changed. But the poll numbers have.
Here's the problem. We're running. He does great. I win. I choose him as my vice presidential candidate, and the Democrats sue because we can't take him along for the ride.
Unfortunately, Governor Christie has endorsed many of the ideas that Barack Obama supports, whether it's Common Core or gun control or the appointment of Sonia Sotomayor or the donation he made to Planned Parenthood. Our next president and our Republican nominee cannot be someone who supports those positions.
I'd like to interrupt this debate on the floor of the Senate. To actually answer the question you asked, which was on entitlements. Do you remember that, everybody? This was a question on entitlements.
Oh, I'll answer
the reason, now you already had your chance, Mark, you blew it.
Cruz, Trump, Rubio, Christie, there they are, and there they were last night. Jay Cost, back to you once again, Weekly Standard, author of A Republic No More, Big Government and the Rise of American Political Corruption. Do you like the way the primary system is working out when you hear that kind of thing? You mentioned earlier the need for a mediating force. How does what we just heard illustrate your need for that to happen?
Well, I don't like it. I think it's from the standpoint of the Republican Party, I think it's grossly inefficient. I think that Republicans spend an inordinate sum of money attacking each other. These are resources that are then not available for general election campaigns. As the clip amply demonstrated, they spent an inordinate amount of time attacking each other on tiny, insignificant points that just nevertheless sort of undermine sort of public confidence in the party, in my opinion. I also think that the primary system has transferred too much authority to the people with informational advantages, which is to say the campaign consultants. I mean, every candidate on stage has dozens of consultants whose job it is to coach them on the finer details of, you know, how to attack and what to wear and how to comb your hair and all of this. And then the high money donors themselves, I think, have inordinate power within the party because, you know, they have to be courted, and they have to be courted early on. Otherwise, you can't run a serious campaign. And I think that from a Republican, and by that I mean small r sort of Republican standpoint, you know, sort of think of it from the perspective that James Madison might bring, where the idea should be that the party nominee represents the views and interests of everybody in the party. Is this a process that facilitates that? And I think the answer to that question is no, is that in this mediating stage, the balance of power is overwhelmingly tipped to a very small number of political and socioeconomic elites.
Let me introduce Dante Scala. He's a professor at the University of New Hampshire, where, of course, the first primaries are going to be held after the Iowa caucuses just a week later. He's author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party and the Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Tell us about the four faces of the Republican Party.
So my co-author Henry Olson and I, based on exit poll data dating back to the 2000 Republican primaries, described four faces or factions of the Republican Party: moderates and liberals, somewhat conservative Republicans, very conservative evangelical voters, and finally, very conservative secular voters, so people who are ideologically quite conservative but don't see religion as an organizing principle of their politics the way that very conservative evangelicals do. And we argue that essentially the race for the nomination is about candidates, one, trying to gain the allegiance of one or more of those factions early on, and then in the second phase, which we see in the later primaries, building a coalition that can deliver a majority of delegates and thus the nomination.
How do the special interests, the groups that were just described by Jay Cost, break down as far as the four faces of the Republican Party are concerned? Are they moderate liberals? Are they somewhat conservative? Are they very conservative evangelicals or very conservative secular people?
Well, they spread themselves out to some degree. I mean, certainly we're seeing right now evangelical leaders surrounding and supporting Ted Cruz in Iowa, and they're trying to rally the faithful behind his candidacy. But take, for instance, the Koch brothers. They, to my mind, would be an example of the, you know, the power of the very conservative but more secular-minded voters. And they obviously have a lot of wealth to bring, and that's kind of like the story of the very conservative seculars. They tend to be more influential in terms of thought leadership and in terms of elite leadership, but they actually represent a very small slice of the Republican electorate. And interestingly, their favorite candidates, dating back to, say, Steve Forbes in the 1990s, their favorite candidates rarely win. They typically have to settle for second best.
So, Jay Cost, what's wrong with that, then? If, in fact, with all of their money, they can't nominate a candidate, they certainly have a right to be heard. The Supreme Court says that spending money is the same thing as free speech, or been protected as if it were free speech. So what's wrong with this process?
Well, I think it comes down to an issue of balance. You consider the vast array of forces within the Republican Party, and they're not just ideological and religious based. There's also geographical. There's geographical differences. There's socioeconomic differences. I mean, there's an infinite number of ways to slice the Republican pie. And it just comes down to a question of balance. Is that the role that each sundry faction has within the Republican Party, is it commensurate with its numbers? Is it commensurate with its, you know, capacity to contribute constructively to the general good of the party? And I think that whereas, you know, again, appreciating the sort of the need for reforms in the first place in the 60s and 70s, I think that there's now this architecture that's been created that really is not very well balanced between the various forces within the party.
Let me go back to Jeff Cowan. The reforms that you were involved in did, in fact, it seemed to me, involve an effort to curtail the power of wealthy elites or established elites in the Democratic Party. Has it worked out that way?
Well, I think what's happened, and this is why I found Jay's piece so interesting, is we've almost created what could be called a primary industrial process. You know, it's like the military industrial. There's suddenly, in the primary world, it's true that there are all these institutions that have grown up, making it much, much more complex. I think, personally, that the process today, even though imperfect, is a lot better than it was and better than most alternatives. If I really had a choice today, I think it'd have fewer superdelegates who have no connection with what people happen to believe at the moment. But in general, I think it's a better process than we've had before. The thing that's so interesting, and maybe you could get Donnie to talk about this, is the way in which the system gets changed every year. Every year, the parties and the states change the system in order to try to game it, thinking they'll help a particular candidate or faction or avoid the problems of the past. And as Donnie points out in his very interesting book, the opposite seems to have happened this year.
Back to Professor Dante Scala. That certainly does appear to be happening. Tell us a bit more about it, if you will, and how it might, in fact, extend the machinations of the Republican National Committee, changing the rules after the loss of Mr. Romney 4 years ago, might, in fact, extend the process much longer than it's gone on before.
That's possible. I mean, certainly every time the losing party tries to reshape the rules to create a better product, I think there have been some successes for the RNC. I mean, for one, they managed to make the process a bit more compact. Like, we're starting in February now. There's no worries about Iowa and New Hampshire voting in December of the year prior to the general election. So they've established some order in the process. I think one of the great, perhaps unintended consequences was, and this gets back to Jay's point, relinquishing control over who got to be on the national debate stage to the media and their standards. And the media's standards for who got on the debate stage tended to be, until lately, their poll standing in national polls. And anyone would tell you who follows this sort of thing is that those national primary early polling is very inaccurate and not at all predictive of who's going to emerge at the end. And yet that was, those were the criteria by which people were sent on and off the main stage and off to the second tier debates that appeared during people's dinner time rather than prime time. I think that's shaped things a lot. And I think it's also opened the door to Donald Trump, who's been masterful with the media for the past half a year.
Barbara Norander, back to you at the University of Arizona, author of The Imperfect Primary, Oddities, Biases, and Strengths of U.S. Presidential Nomination Politics. It seems to me that not only are the national polls somewhat inaccurate, they don't reflect what happens state by state, but the process works state by state.
Yes, that's true. I mean, we have elections in a sequential order, and each state has its own sort of political tradition, so based on, you know, the composition of the electorate, whether there's more or fewer religious voters or more or fewer moderates or conservative voters varies by the state. And in some ways that sort of lets a numerous people to win in different states, and that sort of prolongs the process.
So, Jay Cost, back to you at the Weekly Standard. What would be a better way to determine who gets to be on the stage rather than having the media use national polls?
Well, I've been noodling for a couple years with an idea that, in my estimation, takes the, a random sample of the candidates, where you have one group of candidates in one primetime debate, and another, and in that situation, because it's randomized, nobody has any sort of advantage or disadvantage. I mean, and I would add, it's not simply sort of the allocation of candidates into whatever primetime debate, but also, you know, how this is reinforced visually during the debate itself, with Donald Trump in the center and the rest of the candidates arrayed based upon their standing in the polls. And then in addition to that, you know, the number of questions they're asked as well, and the time that is allocated to each candidate tends to mimic the poll positions.
Dante Scala at the University of New Hampshire, how has this worked out in your state, do you think, this year?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump has led here in New Hampshire for months now, so it's hard to deny, you know, the influence of kind of national forces on our small state. Now, there's still a few weeks left to go, and I think Iowa could change a lot of people's minds here because we're famous for choosing at the last minute, but certainly you're finding candidates like Chris Christie and John Kasich, you know, focusing on New Hampshire intensely, but they have to keep in mind, you know, their performance on the national debate stage matters as well. And I think that's been a real game changer, is that no longer is it the case that Iowa and New Hampshire Republicans or Democrats have a monopoly on candidates. Now, Republican voters coast to coast, 10 million, 20 million, can watch these debates and decide for themselves. They don't have to rely on media accounts, and they don't have to rely on New Hampshire Republicans' judgment the way they once did.
Jeff Cowan, you said earlier that you think the process as it has worked out, the primary process, is about the best we can do. Do you agree, though, that the dominance of the media and their ability to choose who gets on the debate stage particularly requires a caveat?
Well, yes, and I do think the process needs to keep improving. I was saying I think it's much better than it was, but I think there are all kinds of ways in which it needs to keep improving. One, most people don't understand the nuances of how the process works. So, for example, in Iowa, only party members can vote in caucuses. In New York, the only party members can vote in primaries. But in New Hampshire, which is going to have a huge influence, people who are not members of the party can vote in a party primary. And that can have a huge difference in how things turn out. One thing we've seen over time is that the press, and you're asking about the role of the press, but the press kind of loves the surprise story. So right now the story is for Iowa that it's 1-2 between Trump and Cruz. But if somebody else does better than was expected, the story coming out of Iowa could be about that person. And if New Hampshire, The same thing could happen in New Hampshire. Somebody that will give a person a boost in New Hampshire, and all of a sudden you could find that New Hampshire, it comes out very differently. This story has not been written yet.
New Hampshire, where, as we just heard, they make up their minds at the last minute. Professor Norander, do you agree with Jeff Cowen? This is the best we can do, although, of course, he indicated it's got to be improved.
Well, there's no perfect system to begin with, and there has been lots of suggestions for reform, and particularly with the calendar. So there were suggestions for regional primaries or primaries scheduled by the size of the population or even a national primary, but none of them has been successful at being enacted. So we're sort of in a process where there are a lot of voices coming in, but also in many years the decision happens before some states have their primaries.
Okay, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you all very much for being on our program. It's been a lot of fun. Barbara Norander, again, at the University of Arizona, author of The Imperfect Primary, Oddities, Biases, and Strengths of U.S. Presidential Nomination Politics. Jeff Cowen, author of Let the People Rule, Theodore Roosevelt and the Birth of the Presidential Primary. He's a professor of communications at USC. Jay Cost, writer at the Weekly Standard, author of A Republic No More, Big Government and the Rise of American Political Corruption. A lot of authors today. Professor Dante Scala at the University of New Hampshire. His book, The Four Faces of the Republican Party in the Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. Great to have you all. Many thanks for being with us. Come back and talk to us again as this process unfolds. A tactic dating back to the earliest days of organized combat is now being used in 21st century Syria. The United Nations says that starvation has become a weapon of war. We'll hear more about that in a moment on today's Talking Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said yesterday that the warring sides in Syria are committing what he called atrocious acts as weapons of war. Today, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, confirmed severe malnutrition among children in the town of Madaya, where 32 people died of starvation last month. Dr. Peter Salama is UNICEF Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa. He joins us today from Amman, Jordan. Doctor, thank you very much for being on our program.
Yeah, my pleasure, Warren.
Can you tell us more about Syria and the use of starvation as a weapon of war? Are both sides equally to blame, or all sides, I guess I should say, in Syria?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that all parties to the conflict in Syria, and there are multiple parties to the conflict there, are all using the tactic of besiegement as part of their tactics of warfare. And within that tactic of besiegement, certainly starvation is one of the modalities by which they're putting pressure on the opposition and the civilian population who they think might be supporting those opposition forces.
So how does it work? What do you mean by besiegement?
Besiegement means basically controlling access to a civilian population, whether it's access of people, whether it's access of commercial goods, whether it's the access of humanitarian goods, really restricting that access. And even though the focus in the last few days has been on Madaya, and indeed the situation in Madaya is truly tragic, there are at least 14 other Madayas in Syria at the moment, 14 or 15 places where the population is really under siege, accounting for about 400,000 people. And beyond that, there is another 4 million people where access is extremely restricted, including in the areas controlled by ISIL or Daesh.
Tell us about the humanitarian consequences.
Well, they're very grave. I mean, what we saw in Madaya is an example. This week, our teams went in yesterday and a few days ago, and what they found was a population that were truly exhausted. They were cold, frightened, and they were desperate. And when they started to really look closely at the population, and we did a nutritional assessment, albeit on a relatively small scale because we didn't have many hours within which to conduct it, they found that the majority of children they were able to assess were indeed moderately or severely malnourished. what was really important as well is that, you know, we often see around the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, malnutrition amongst children under five. But it's very rare that we see malnutrition in older age groups, older kids, adolescents, adults. We found severe malnutrition amongst adolescents and adults in Madaya, and that usually means a very late stage of a famine or a crisis. And to be honest, in the Middle East, I'm not aware of any time in recent decades where we've seen that.
I take it that people on your staff have literally seen people die before their eyes.
Yes, very sadly, in the mission that went to Madaya yesterday, they went to the makeshift clinic, which is the only operational health center in Madaya for 40,000 people, and they found two boys sharing a bed in the basement of this makeshift clinic. And indeed, one of the UNICEF doctors took the pulse of one of the 16-year-old boys and found that he was really in his last breaths, and he died before their eyes, before they could do anything. They tried to resuscitate him, but unfortunately, he didn't make it. He died of starvation.
You said these people are desperate. Obviously, that's the case. What are they doing? How do they try to get water? How do they try to get food?
Well, fortunately, they have wells within the city of Madaya. In fact, Madaya, your listeners may not know, was actually a fairly affluent town before the war a few years ago. And it was a resort town, actually, on the Syrian-Lebanese border. And so this population has exhausted all of their wealth, all of their coping mechanisms. Fortunately, they do have some social services remaining, such as water, but the health services have basically stopped. There hasn't been immunization for almost a year, for example, for children in Madaya, and there is no capacity. Until we got there, there had been no capacity to treat these cases of severe acute malnutrition. In terms of food, until the last few months, the siege was not as tight, and there were some commercial products getting in, but the siege has been tightened in the last few months, and really very little has been going in or out, and that's why the situation has deteriorated so much. They've been really doing their best, eating wild plants, wild foods, whatever they can get their hands on, or paying extortionate amounts of money for the very small amount of basic foodstuffs that can be smuggled into Madaya.
What happens to women when they need to breastfeed?
Well, as you know, I mean, if a mother's malnourished, then it's very likely her child is going to be malnourished, and we're seeing that in different parts of Syria. We try and encourage women to breastfeed always for the first 6 months, but in Madaya it's particularly difficult, and even more difficult is once that period is finished of exclusive breastfeeding to know what the weaning foods would be for a child after 6 months in this situation is very, very difficult.
You said that this resembles the late stages of crises such as famine. You were, however, able to get some convoys in for the first time this week. Tell us what you were able to bring and what the impact has been.
So you were able to bring in about 20 trucks yesterday. Those included therapeutic commodities for the treatment of severe acute malnutrition, medicines, and specialized foodstuffs. They also included water and hygiene items, blankets, and warm clothes for the women and children in Madaya, as well as educational items. All the schools have been shut for more than a year. Other organizations, such as the Red Cross, brought in other foodstuffs. And other UN agencies also brought in the basic food rations and other relief items for the population. So the population, at least for now, will get access to food and basic essential medicines, and will be able to treat those cases of severe acute malnutrition. But really, it's not about one-off convoys, Warren, now. What we're really calling for is sustained and unconditional access to these populations, so we can go in and train staff, so we can go in and monitor the programs, so we can go in and evacuate the women and children and indeed the men who can't be managed locally because their complications are so severe. And we're also calling for a lifting of the siege on all of the 400,000 people of Syria that are living under siege today.
I was going to say, it's not just Madaya, as you indicated earlier, a town of 42,000 people, but rather 400,000 people altogether who are suffering in this way. Madaya, of course, has gotten a lot of attention. There's been coverage there by the news media. We've seen children just skin and bones and the horrible consequences. But what about the long-term consequences? What does it mean for a nation if that many of its population are malnourished, particularly when they're children, particularly when there are older kids, as you indicated is the case here?
Yeah, it's got enormous consequences for the future of the country. We know that children that are chronically malnourished, for example, have much lower IQ levels eventually, have lower income potential, lower academic achievement. So it has really long-term consequences for the productivity and economic welfare of the population. And beyond, of course, the headlines of the life-saving issues, Warren, we know as well that school has basically shut down for many Syrian children. In fact, the conflict has gone on now almost into 5 years. It's almost into its sixth year. So there are many children in Syria that have never seen the inside of a classroom. They might be 10, 11, 12 years of age. And we're really calling for the international community to help us avoid the risk of a loss of Syrian children.
Whether it's the Assad regime or the rebels or of whatever stripe they may be, what do they say when you ask that they lift the siege and stop this? How do they justify what they're doing?
Well, really, everyone justifies it by saying it's a war, it's an active conflict, and this is what happened in an active conflict. Of course, we challenge that. There are laws of war, and the international humanitarian law provisions apply in these kinds of conflict. And unfortunately, we've seen in Syria a systematic and flagrant abuse of international humanitarian law to the extent that we've rarely seen in recent history. And I think it is time for the international community to hold the parties to the conflict accountable for these abuses of international humanitarian law, and time to for the allies of many of these parties to the conflict to put pressure on them to really abide by those provisions of the laws of war. Fortunately, there is a meeting, an emergency meeting being called today of the UN Security Council, and we're very much hoping that the result of that is indeed the lifting of the siege of Madaya and all of the other towns and cities under siege in Syria.
Dr. Peter Salama, again, UNICEF Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa, joining us from Amman, Jordan. Thank you so much for telling our listeners what's going on there.
Thanks a lot for having me.
To the Point, produced this week by Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Christine Detz, Jenny Hamill, Sarah Sweeney, and Paul von Zielbauer, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.